Well, good evening, everybody. It's a very, very great pleasure to have Norman Lamont here to give the fourth of these lectures in which chancellors reflect. Of all the chancellors participating in this series, Norman was, of course, the one who established the present framework for macroeconomic policy, which has proved so successful and so enduring. And I refer to the inflation target. I think that's an amazing and a very important achievement. And the question, of course, arises, if it's so good, why didn't we have it earlier? I thought that would be an interesting question to ask at a dinner we had last week, which Norman couldn't come to, but the others were there. And, of course, all the others said, well, it would have been premature to have had it any earlier. But I think it's an interesting question, and perhaps Norman will comment on it. In fact, it's even possible to suppose that if we'd had it, we could have avoided some of the disasters, which shall be nameless for me, but might have been avoided if we'd had an inflation target. Norman is, of course, much better qualified for the job of chancellor than most chancellors, because he has an economics degree. Unfortunately, it's from Cambridge. But we still think of him as very much the economist's chancellor, which makes him especially welcome. So welcome to the London School of Economics, Norman. We look forward to your reflections. So please welcome Norman Lamont.
Richard, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, can I just say how delighted I am to be one of the participants in these lectures. I know I have the impossible task of trying to come up anywhere near the quality of those who've gone before me. Where shall I start? Well, I think at the beginning is probably a good place. The day that I became Chancellor of the Exchequer, which was in the last week of 1990, I went into the Treasury, into that very long, dark room that was then the Chancellor's office, and met Terry Burns, who was then the Chief Economic Advisor to the Treasury, who said to me, Chancellor, you do realise you will soon be the most unpopular man in Britain. And that was the only Treasury forecast in my time that was ever correct. I don't think even Terry quite realised where things were going to get to. I remember several years later, after I'd stopped being Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I got in a taxi, and the taxi driver said to me, Mr. Lamont, I saved your life. And I said, how's that? He said, well, I was driving up St. James's Street one day, and you were crossing the street, and the man in the back said, 500 quid if you run the bastard down. Sir Samuel Britton, who I see here tonight, distinguished writer, political economist, wrote recently in the Financial Times, who now remembers the ERM? Few. Well, I wish it were like that. He went on to say, but mention it to a politician and you'll get a shudder. Well, I do intend to talk tonight about the ERM, because one of the things I've discovered is that I am an exam question. I first discovered this when my two children were doing A-levels. And one of the things I discovered, we're all, as politicians, used to finding, or as any individual is who is reported in the newspapers or written about in the newspapers, we all know that anything that appears about us in the newspapers is wrong. What I hadn't realised was that anything that appears about you in a school textbook is wrong as well. But it's very flattering to be an exam question. I remember once, I think in 1991, I received a piece of paper which came through the post. And it was an exam question, and the top it said, the University of Reading. and it was from the Department of Sociology, and there were about 20 questions. And one section was on the sociology of humour, and question 15 was, which Chancellor of the Exchequer used humour to the best effect, Winston Churchill, Lloyd George, or Norman Lamont? I thought, oh, this is very nice. And then I looked up at the date of the exam question, and the date of the exam paper was April the 1st. There are many things that I could talk about. I could just talk about the Treasury as an institution, the life in the Treasury. I saw that Dennis Healy did quite a lot of that. And I saw that he went out of his way to say that he didn't really like the Treasury civil servants. He preferred those in the Ministry of Defence. In that, actually, I had lunch with him today, and I said to him, you know, you were echoing Winston Churchill, because when Winston Churchill became Chancellor of the Exchequer, he wrote complainingly to a friend, all these chaps here speak Persian. I prefer generals and admirals. Well, I didn't really. I liked the people in the Treasury. I liked the Calvinists of the Inland Revenue. In my book, I described the charms of the old building of the Treasury before Gordon Brown turned it into a Hyatt Hotel. Because in the old Treasury, you had these wonderful wide corridors with red linoleum and double swing doors. I said that it reminded me of a Russian psychiatric hospital. And one always expected the doors to swing open and a trolley to come by with some unconscious patient. Malcolm Rifkin, when reviewing my book on my time at the Treasury, said, referring to my description of the Treasury as a psychiatric hospital, he said, Norman Lamont has confirmed what many of us have thought about the inmates of the Treasury for a long time. I could talk about the PFI, which is one of the things that still looms large, and I would argue has been somewhat misused. I could talk about the Maastricht Treaty. That took up a very, very large part of my time at the Treasury, a huge part of it. That was the treaty from which I negotiated the opt-out for sterling, but it was the treaty I didn't want to sign and didn't sign in the end and was merciful when somebody did it for me. Or I suppose I could have talked about the process of budget making. It is, I think, quite an interesting subject in itself, and I'd like to have talked about the three budgets I had the privilege of presenting. The first of them drew the sting of the poll tax while we were still developing and thinking up the council tax. My second budget was on the eve of the 1992 election, literally, which put one in an impossible position. It was definitely the most political of all my budgets. It completely wrong-footed Labour, who weren't sure whether to oppose or support a lower rate ban because of its optical appearance of giving some help to the lower paid. But I think looking back on it, it wasn't a very good budget, but it did help us to win the election. My next budget, my third budget, helped us to lose the election. But it was definitely, and I shall come to it later, it was definitely my best budget. Ladies and gentlemen, just before I come to the ERM, I would like to say that obviously I have to refer sometimes to things before and things afterwards, and nothing that I say should be interpreted as any criticism of anyone who's spoken here before in this series of lectures or anyone who is going to speak in these lectures subsequently. Kenneth Clark is a wonderful chap, sound on everything except the euro. The ERM today has no friends, and it is widely regarded as a disaster, although there have been a few dissenting voices. The other day, Sir Samuel Britton wrote a piece in the FT saying that it was too soon, really, to come to a final verdict. And Sir Alan Budd, the Provost of Queen's College, Cambridge, who was the successor to Terry Burns as Chief Economic Advisor at the Treasury, in his Wincott lecture wrote this: "The case can be made that the ERM was an economic triumph and marked the turning point in our economic performance." I think it's worth recalling that the decision by John Major to join the ERM in October 1990 was one that was greeted with euphoria in the press, by the CBI, even on the stock market that rose 60 points on the day. Joining the ERM, I think, dramatically increased the stature of John Major, because he had, after all, succeeded where Nigel Lawson and Geoffrey Howard failed. He'd succeeded in persuading Margaret Thatcher to drop her long-standing opposition. How he did it is a complete mystery to me, but he must have had some very secret gift that persuaded her, against her Duggan opposition, to change her mind. My own attitude, and I was not involved in the decisions at the time. There was a very peremptory announcement at Cabinet. I was told just 24 hours, I think, before the decision was made. My own attitude towards fixed and floating rates was one of agnosticism, but slightly in favour of floating. I remember the day that we joined the ERM, meeting a senior civil servant in the Treasury, and I said to him, "What have we done this for?" And he said, "Oh, for political reasons." And I remember I replied, "Well, I don't think I would like to have given up the flexibility of the exchange rate." I certainly never imagined that this decision was going to be one that would involve me as much as it did. The attractions of the ERM for its advocates developed out of the experience of other policies. The Conservative government that came to opposition in 1979 was obviously determined to reduce inflation. Inflation when they came to office was around 15%. But attempts to control inflation by setting quantitative targets for money supply in the early 80s were not entirely successful. Even if inflation came down, this owed quite a lot to the rise in the exchange rate, as well as to monetary targets, if at all. There were arguments that continued about what was the proper role for the exchange rate. Some argued that one should fix interest rates and that the exchange rate could take care of itself. Others argued this couldn't be allowed because of the impact of the exchange rate on the price level. After all, the exchange rate wouldn't necessarily go up. The exchange rate might go down with adverse consequences for inflation. But in the early 80s, sterling was allowed to float freely, but with severe consequences for exporters. Supporters of the ERM argued at the time that if we tied our currency to low inflation currencies and then set interest rates accordingly, British inflation would fall to the level of the lowest. This is what Edmund Dell dubbed exchange rate monetarism. In 1985, Geoffrey Howe and Nigel Lawson attempted to persuade Margaret Thatcher to join the ERM, but as a way of buttressing monetary policy. She rejected this, and from 1987 to 88, there was the policy of shadowing the Deutschmark. But in June 1989, after a lot of argument, ministers agreed amongst themselves the so-called Madrid conditions for joining the ERM. These included abandonment of exchange controls within the EU, increased competition in various areas, and lower inflation. The latter, I would argue, was probably the most important condition, and it was the one that was obviously not met when we joined the ERM, because inflation in October 1990 was at the surprisingly high rate of 10.9%. It should be noted, I think, that this concern and this interest in fixed exchange rates wasn't just confined to Europe. In other parts of the world also, countries in Asia and in South America were finding it difficult to run independent domestic monetary policies, and there were many different regimes of pegging exchange rates to the dollar or having currency boards, both in Southeast Asia and in South America. The main characteristic of the ERM was a regime of fixed exchange rates that linked our currency to the others in the system, the key one, of course, being the Deutschmark, the linchpin of the system, to which we were linked at the central rate of 2.95 Deutschmarks to the pound, with fluctuation bands of 6% on either side. Many people who supported the ERM did not appreciate how it was meant to work when put into practice. Interest rates remained the main tool of monetary policy, but now the overriding factor in setting them was to meet the UK's ERM obligations and to keep the pound close to its central rate against the other ERM currencies. This wasn't some additional discipline, but it was a complete regime for interest rates. The consequence was, for a high inflation country, like we were at the time, that interest rates would have to be higher until our inflation rate moved into line with that of the best, which was usually that of Germany, the anchor of the system. And indeed, from the moment we joined the ERM, our interest rates were inevitably heavily influenced by those of Germany. The conditions when we joined the ERM, and we joined the ERM about 7 or 8 weeks before I became Chancellor of the Exchequer, and they could hardly have been less propitious. As I've said, firstly, inflation was 10.9%. Secondly, we were entering a recession. Just before I became Chancellor, the monthly unemployment rate had risen by 32,000, the highest figure for 4 years. John Major at the time as Chancellor was reluctant to use the word recession, but when I became Chancellor, it was pretty clear to me that we were in a recession, and I used the word, although, of course, there was tremendous argument about how long it would last and how deep it would be. People came to believe that the ERM caused the recession, but it didn't cause the recession. The recession was inevitable because we had high inflation and we had had high interest rates, 13%, then up to 15% for a whole 12 months. The history of the next 2 years is familiar. We had a recession that lasted for a year and a half to the second quarter of 1992. Housing repossession soared, bankruptcy soared, unemployment went from 1.7 to 2.8 million, 1.7 to 2.8 million. Yeah. All this time, I featured in the Sun newspaper, alternating, I remember, with Graham Taylor, the manager of the English football team. Sometimes I was the turnip, and sometimes he was the potato, and sometimes it was the other way around. But I've never met Graham Taylor. I've got great admiration for him, and I feel we've got a lot in common, and one day I would like to meet him. I remember also the Sun at that time produced... I remember I was taken out to lunch by the editor of the Sun, and he gave me a very lavish lunch, and then suddenly he handed me the cover for the next day, page one of the Sun, which had a huge dartboard with my face in the middle of it, which was going to be sent, was going to be on every copy of the Sun that morning. He gave it to me and he said, "There's nothing personal in this, of course." The pressure that was on me was very much, of course, to talk up the economy. I remember one fellow minister in the cabinet wrote to me and said, "If you just say there'll be a recovery, there will be a recovery." Well, if only it had been that simple. But there was always this pressure, which I did my best to resist and did my best to be realistic, though I didn't always succeed. And, of course, I think looking back on it, my reference to green shoots was not quite as ill-timed as people thought at the time, though my wife at the time quite rightly said, "How can you have green shoots in the autumn?" All the time, there were calls for interest rate cuts from the CBI, from the press, from members of parliament, and, of course, we could only and should only deliver them slowly. People often forget that in the ERM, actually, we cut interest rates all the time. I remember the look of horror over John Major's face when I did say to him, "You know, one day we might have to put interest rates up." But actually, we cut them from 14 to 10%. That had to be done carefully because we always had to keep the market hungry, the market waiting. We didn't want to snatch at it, and we had to have regard to our position within the bands. The problem was that although interest rates were coming down, inflation was coming down very much faster. So real interest rates were rising, and rising quite sharply. When we joined the ERM, inflation was nearly 11%. Interest rates were 14%. By September 1992, inflation was just under 4%, and interest rates were still 10%, a real interest rate if you measure it against the RPI, which I know there could be an argument about, of 6% or so. If we had wanted to cut interest rates faster, of course we couldn't do so under the system. As Sir Alan Budd put it in his Winnicott lecture, he said, Norman Lamont, in the role of Ulysses, was tied to the mast. Actually, the Financial Times did a wonderful misprint of this. It said, Norman Lamont, in the role of Ulysses, was tied to the mast, his eyes stuffed with wax, so that he was unable to hear the siren calls for reflation. The basic problem in the ERM was, as became more and more apparent, the contrast between the needs of the German economy and the UK economy. And this became greater as time went by. Reunification had taken place in 1989. Germany was enjoying a construction boom following reunification. And during that period, we having started off with inflation being the main problem, still a problem, of course, but the UK was moving deeper and deeper into recession. The UK needed lower interest rates. Germany needed higher interest rates, although Germany's inflation was benign compared with our own. In December 2001, this contrast between the needs of the two economies and this constraint on our ability to get rates down became very marked when Germany started putting up rates. And it meant that from the period from September 1991 to May 1992, interest rates were unchanged for all that time at 10.5%. But inflation in May 1992 was 4.3%. At that time, I really did feel like Ulysses, really did feel tied to the mast. At the same point, sometime after December 2000, at some point, a few months after that, I think the wax in Ulysses' ears became a little bit loose, and I began to hear some of the siren calls, particularly after the second German rate increase in July 2003. And I became increasingly to believe that we were going to have overkill on inflation, that inflation was going to be driven down very much at the expense of recovery. I debated this endlessly with officials in the Treasury, all of whom but one were strongly in favour of soldiering on. I remember one particular civil servant put it quite bluntly to me. He said, look, this policy was decided by the present Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister, and the Foreign Secretary, and you've been here less than 2 years, and you think you could change it. Are you sure you have the right to do this, just to give up when it's proving difficult? I was not entirely convinced and tried to persuade the Prime Minister that we should consider suspending our membership. He would not entertain considering that, and I accepted that, and that was the end of the matter, little seeing what was about to hit us and what was about to happen. Another complication with the ERM was the connection between the ERM, the euro, and Maastricht. Many people saw the ERM, but not myself, not Nigel Lawson. Many people saw the ERM as leading in an evolutionary way towards the euro. As a result of the Maastricht Treaty that had been negotiated, France was due to have a referendum in the third week in September on Maastricht and the euro. The market sensed that the French might vote no, as you recall they nearly did, and speculation built up, and the markets had a fixed date against which to speculate. Initially, the currency in the front line was the lira, and the speculation, as I say, built up with the date being the point around which it centred. The pressures continued. On September the 8th, the first domino to go was Finland, who had their currency tied to the ECU, and they floated the marker, having lost a huge part of their foreign exchange reserves. After them came the Swedish krona. As you may recall, mortgage rates went up 5% in a week. Overnight rates went up 75%. Then on September the 11th, the lira fell out of its band, and the lira was devalued by 7%. At the time, I didn't think that 7% would do them much good, and indeed it didn't. It wasn't the end of their agony. There was a second devaluation, and then the Italians floated. The pound was not helped, as people may recall, by remarks made by Dr. Schlesinger to a newspaper, which he called unauthorized remarks, where he had said that he thought the pound was... he made these remarks on, I think, September the 15th. He said that he thought the pound was overvalued. And I was at dinner in the American Embassy. I spent a lot of time trying to persuade Robin Lee Pemberton, the governor, to persuade Dr. Schlesinger to correct these remarks. But he kept just saying, well, they were unauthorized, but he wouldn't actually withdraw them. And on September the 16th, I expected it to be a very difficult day, and indeed it was. By 8:40 that morning, we'd lost £1 billion out of the reserves. I think the rest of that day is pretty well known to people. At 10 o'clock, I put... interest rates up to 12%. I remember sitting in the Treasury, watching the screen, waiting for the news of the interest rate decision to come through. Sterling was flat along the bottom of its band. In effect, it was outside its band. And the screen just didn't move when interest rates went up. And I felt rather like a doctor watching a heart machine and having to conclude that the patient was clinically dead. Unfortunately, I had a lot of difficulty in persuading my fellow ministers in the cabinet that the patient was clinically dead. I recommended to John Major that we should leave the ERM immediately. He wanted to consult other ministers. We had spent a long time discussing this. I and the governor recommended several times that we should leave the ERM, but ministers wanted us to put rates up further in a final attempt to 15%, which had no effect. But I think the decision to put rates up to 15% was the worst decision of the day. And, of course, it meant that the hemorrhaging of the reserves went on and on and on. I would just like to make one point about the reserves. And that is, of course, much of the press afterwards, quite understandably, concentrated on the loss of the reserves. But there wasn't always a distinction between decisions to support the pound, so-called intervention, about which I was always sceptical and was always reluctant to intervene. The greatest part of our loss of reserves didn't come from discretionary decisions of futile attempts. We weren't chucking money trying to support the pound. But under the system of the ERM, once a currency is outside its bands, people can buy sterling, could buy sterling, come to the Bank of England and demand to be paid at the official parity. It was a license to print money in that moment between 10 o'clock when we refused to get out and the early evening when we finally did. I felt, I have to say, a certain relief when it had all happened. It's not remotely true. It's not true to say, as has been reported endlessly, that I sang in my bath, any more than it's true I ever said je ne regrette rien about economic policy. But I did feel a degree of relief about it, because I did feel that now we were embarked on a different path and that the future would work out well. Of course, there were widespread calls for my resignation. I considered that, and I didn't resign really for two reasons. Firstly, the Prime Minister asked me not to, and secondly, colleagues said to me that if I had, it would certainly have just shifted the pressure to him, who was, after all, the architect of the policy, and as he said it, he saw me as his air raid shelter. In any case, whether that was right or wrong is arguable, but I have to say that I was glad that I stayed on for another 8 months, because it gave me an opportunity to reconstruct policy. I think it is worth emphasizing about the ERM. I described earlier what happened in Finland, what happened in Sweden, what happened in Ireland. I'm always surprised at the extent to which people see it purely as a British crisis. But in that week in September, eight countries either devalued or floated. Eight countries lost a very large part of their foreign exchange reserves at that time. There was another country, France, which a few months later, it had a delayed crisis, and it was forced off its central rate, having spent something, according to newspapers, 150 billion francs trying to support the franc within the ERM. Of course, later, the tide of speculation moved on to other fixed-rate regimes outside Europe. In Asia, the Thai baht, the Malaysian ringgit, the Korean won. I remember the Korean Minister of Finance was put in prison and impeached. I was rather alarmed by this at the time. Could we have avoided the situation and the crisis as it hit us? Well, there are a number of questions that need to be addressed. First of all, there is the issue of, did we join at too high a rate? I know many people believe that to be the case. I can't shed any light on why the rate of 2.95 was chosen. Plainly, it was a demanding one, but I don't know why that rate was chosen, except that I was always told it was the inflation-adjusted average over the decade before. I was always amused to hear that Mr. Delors was reported to have said he didn't mind what rate the British had as long as it wasn't the one they wanted. I'm not convinced that the rate was too high a rate. When you look at the subsequent behaviour of sterling, and particularly, of course, it went down below 250 up to 1987, but from 1987 until quite recently, it was much nearer the 295, and at some points has been over the three Deutschmarks. But be that as it is, that is not capable of being resolved decisively. Should we and could we have devalued? I don't believe that that would have helped, because the real problem for output in employment was not the level of the exchange rate, it was the level of interest rates. And had we devalued but tried to remain within the system, I'm sure that we would have had to pay a premium on interest rates, as indeed those countries who, in September 1992, who did devalue but remained within the system, they had to pay a price in terms of higher rates. Now, the title of this talk was Out of the Ashes, because I did want to talk about the reconstruction of policy. But before I do that, could I just say what I think about the experience and the benefits and the disbenefits of our membership of the ERM? It was dramatically successful in forcing inflation down within a very short period of time, from 10.9% to 3.6% on September the 16th, 1992. For the whole of 1993, inflation was below 2%, which was the best inflation performance for 30 years. It was a real decisive break with inflation. For the whole period of the government of Mrs. Thatcher, the average inflation was 6%. but whenever we seemed to have got finally on top of it, it bobbed up again. Wasn't policy over tight? Well, I've admitted the contradictions in my own mind. I'm conscious of the contradictions as I speak to you. I became, in summer 2002, concerned about the tightness of policy. And yet, as Alan Budd has asked, too tight for what? Too tight possibly for output and employment, but not really if one wanted to get inflation down to really low levels, to German levels. And inflation was knocked on the head. Could this objective have been achieved by other means? Making the Bank of England independent, perhaps? Well, I was attracted to the idea of making the Bank of England independent, and I did twice try to persuade John Major about that, but he was not interested in that. But I don't think we could have achieved everything with an independent Bank of England at that time, because I think a newly independent Bank of England operating a tight money policy against the conditions that existed then, it could only have done so if there was a consensus about what needed to be done. And I think an independent Bank of England would not have survived the sort of criticism and public outcry that there was with the level of interest rates we had within the ERM and all the vitriol that was, understandably perhaps, addressed against the ERM would have been addressed against a newly independent Bank of England. Could we have operated a discretionary policy which would have had the same effects, i.e. continue, after all, interest rates were at 15% for a whole year up until we joined the ERM in 1990? I know politicians. I know the politicians I was working with. I know myself, and I've said the doubts that even I had at various times. I don't think that we would have gone on to get the full gains that, whether we wanted them or not, thought it through, we did get. We would have relaxed interest rates probably when inflation had got to 4% or something like that. Don't forget, there was an election looming in 1991. What we often forget when we joined the ERM was that we didn't just give up the right to choose our interest rate, we gave that up. But we also effectively gave up the right to choose our inflation rate. The system implied German inflation rates. My view is that we got benefits from being a member of the ERM, and we got the benefits from leaving. The last was obviously a matter of luck. But had we continued, inflation would have been driven too low, and I think we would have had a very anemic recovery. It seems to me that in many ways the ERM was a tool that disintegrated in my hands when it had outlived its usefulness. But the effects, I think, of being in and then leaving were ones that worked to the advantage of our economy. People say, yes, we got the benefits when we left, but I think the benefits when we left were only there because of the benefits that we got when we were in. After we left the ERM, of course, interest rates could be cut much more aggressively. Interest rates were cut in 1-point steps down to 6% in January 1993. And during this time, I had to reconstruct policy. My new policy was announced to the House of Commons Treasury Select Committee on the 8th of October 1992. And as Lord Layard has said, it consisted firstly of an inflation target, the institution of regular monthly meetings with the governor, and regular inflation reports. This regime has worked remarkably well. It's essentially the regime that the Independent Bank of England operates on today. It was further built on by Kenneth Clark, who took additional steps on the publication of the minutes. I must say, I mean, far be it from me to attack myself, but I'm slightly surprised at the brilliant press it's had. David Smith in the Sunday Times called it the most brilliant piece of policy making in the post-war period, the basis of the stability we enjoy today. Sir Alan Budd, in his Winnicott lecture again, said, I think without a trace of irony, it is universally acknowledged the current framework for monetary policy is as close to perfection as fallible men can hope to achieve. Wow. Well, I hope you'll forgive me for quoting this. I'm not sure that I looked in my own book to see what I wrote about the inflation target, and unfortunately I only devoted half a page to it. I am pleased that the inflation target has worked well, but I'm sure this isn't the end of history. I was rather surprised that Anatole Kaletsky thought that the new regime, which I introduced, was, and so I believe this view is also held by Patrick Minford, was even more important than the Bank of England being independent. They argued that what the bank did was as important as the fact of the bank's independence. But I think I very much welcome the independence of the Bank of England, and I think the framework that I was able to bequeath enabled us to get the benefits from the ERM to be maintained and to be made permanent. I don't think we could have had an inflation target until we had got inflation down to the really low levels we did after we left the ERM. My last act as Chancellor, my last significant act as Chancellor, was the budget of 1993. The recession had played havoc with the public finances. I introduced a savage budget. It was really three budgets in one, because I didn't just announce tax increases, I legislated for tax increases for the next 3 years. As Peter Riddle wrote in the Times, it doesn't really much matter who's Chancellor for the next 3 years. Those tax increases totaled £17.5 billion. The most unpopular of all was VAT on fuel and power, for which I think there was a perfectly logical and coherent case, and I was sorry that the House of Commons partially voted it down. The budget, predictably, was wildly unpopular. The Daily Mirror had a picture of me as a blue Eskimo under the headline, "The Iceman Cometh, a cheap and shabby budget for a cheap and shabby man." The Sun called it Nightmare on Norm Street. Anatole Kaletsky called it a budget to pay for Norman's mistakes. Well, it was wildly unpopular, but I think it was right. I think it was probably the best thing I ever did, though the main beneficiary was Gordon Brown, who inherited a strong fiscal position, was able to blame the Conservative Party for the tax increases. It was all too much for the Conservative Party, albeit the economy had now stabilised, unemployment was falling, the economy began to grow again, and had been growing since the second quarter of 1992. The Prime Minister offered me in May another job in the Cabinet, but I felt it would be better if I returned to the back benches. I remember the Sun, on the day I left the Treasury, had a picture of me with my back to the camera walking away from the Treasury, and underneath the headline was the picture all Britain wanted to see. But I had some consolation. A few weeks later, I was walking through Notting Hill, and there was a tramp sitting on the pavement. I promise you this is true, drinking out of a meths bottle. And he suddenly raised his meths bottle to me, and he creaked away, and he said, "Mr. Lamont, it's all coming right, and someone else is getting the credit." Peter Jay wrote about my time as Chancellor. Norman Lamont evidently never believed in ERM membership. I think, as I've tried to explain, it was a bit more nuanced than that. Norman Lamont evidently never believed in ERM membership, but accepted it as the price of office and lived like Cardinal Wolsey, to wish that he had given his convictions as high priority as loyalty to his political master. I think that's a reference to Shakespeare's Henry VIII. Had I but served my God as well as I have served my king, he would not have left me naked to my enemies. But I know from Lord Irving's experience that politicians who compare themselves with Cardinal Wolsey get into deep trouble. To go on, Peter Jay said, to that extent, Norman Lamont's economics were better than John Major's, but his ethics were not. He invited his own tragedy because he who lives by political calculation must expect to die by political miscalculation, as he did just at the moment when he had got the economic policy he wanted, which was probably also as close as Britain had been to having a coherent economic strategy for about 15 years. Well, I don't complain too much about that. It seems to me that in politics, you often have to compromise. You often have to make difficult choices. Politics is described as the art of the possible, though to me it's always seemed the art of choosing between the incredible and the absolutely impossible. And that was the situation, I think, for much of the time I was Chancellor. Thank you very much indeed.
Lots to think about, lots of jokes to remember. Norman, are you going to go back to the podium? I know there's somebody over here who wants to ask you a question already.
Thank you very much. My name's Andrew Edwards, and I'm a student union leader. I just wanted to know, back to the ERM, Norman, that when the Bank of England were buying pounds because whoever was selling them was selling a lot of pounds, surely that, if you like, left too few pounds in the system to actually make the pound, it would make the pound less volatile because there are less pounds to be bought because the Bank of England has bought a lot of them. And many of the papers at the time said it was actually a good thing that the Bank of England was buying pounds because it left the British pound less volatile to future fluctuations. And I just wondered if you had a view. Thank you.
Well, the effects of intervention take a long time to come through. The effects of intervention have to be counteracted by sterilizing measures. What we needed was a policy to counter inflation. I don't think the effects would be as you said. The pound was plunging down. Intervention was completely pointless. It wasn't going to be able to arrest the pound, either in a dirty float or in a free float. And I don't really see that it could have operated as you said.
Chris Giles from the Financial Times. Can I just take you back to your 1992 budget, which you skated over slightly at the beginning? You could say that not only was it reckless with the public finances, but also by being so successful politically has left the Tories in the dire political state they're now in by winning that election, which was an election to lose. How do you feel about maybe being characterised as the man with such a brilliant political budget left the Tories in quite a dire state?
Well, I don't see how, if we won the election, it left us in a dire strait. If you mean winning the election, I won an election it would have been better to have lost, because if we'd lost it, Labour would have had the ERM crisis and Labour would have then had the blame. Look, in reality, you can't choose to lose an election. You can't deliberately say, I don't want to win this election, I'm going to go out to lose it because I know what's going to happen. I mean, frankly, that is incredible, and you can't really mean it. Can I comment, though, on two points? One about the looseness of the budget. The one thing, if I had my time again, I'd never make any jokes. The one thing one shouldn't do is be too flippant about it. The 1992 budget, looking back on it, was over expansionary was too generous. But I genuinely believed that the modest, they were very modest tax reductions that I made in that budget. I genuinely believed that those were consistent with a responsible attitude and with a responsible estimate of what the PSBR would turn out to be. I was wrong about that, but I genuinely believed I would never have just thrown caution to the winds for the chance to win an election. I thought if I had this very, as I thought, rather clever wheeze, the lower rate band. I know lots of tax purists don't like it, but Neil Kinnock couldn't make up his mind whether it really was a tax cut for the poor or whether it was something else, and he didn't know whether to vote for it or against it. It was worth it just for the moment of seeing that almost. But it was a very modest tax reduction indeed. But I was wrong in the, we had a lot of debate in the Treasury about it, and I was wrong in what I expected the PSBR outturn to be. If I could just say one other thing. When you talked about the Tories where they are today, one of the things that is commonly stated about the ERM rather than the 1992 budget is that it destroyed the reputation of the Conservative Party for economic competence. And I would just like to address that point, because obviously for me it's rather a heavy burden to bear. But there are two measures of economic confidence, and one of them is by Murray, and the other is by NOP. And actually, those measures did show that in 1997 and 1996, the Conservative Party in economic competence ratings was ahead of the Labour Party. And you know, if the Conservative Party is now behind the Labour Party in economic competence, it might just have something to do with the competence of the Chancellor of Exchequer rather than what happened in 1992. The other thing that is commonly said is that the Conservative Party has flatlined. This is always the cliche in the Sunday Telegraph. Flatlined in the polls ever since 1992. What it says is the Conservative Party dived out of the polls in 1992 and have flatlined ever since. And that's the plight of the Conservative Party today. In January 1990, well, actually, back of my book, which I'll give a plug for in a minute, at the back of my book, I've published all the opinion polls since 1990. And I would challenge anyone, if you gave them to someone from Mars who didn't know when the ERM had happened, I promise you they could not tell by looking at the opinion polls when we left the ERM. And in January 1993, the Conservative Party stood at 37% in the polls, rather above where it currently is. And there has been no flat line. What happened was the Conservative Party gradually fell down, but it, in response to a whole series of things like BSE, sleaze, a whole lot of other things, and the arrival of Tony Blair, the party went down to 20%, I think, in 1996. And this whole idea that it's just flatlined since September the 16th, 1992, is just one of those things that everybody says, but when you actually look at the statistics, it doesn't really have any bearing in fact.
It has been some reports that sometime before the crisis came to sometime before the crisis in mid-September, it was proposed as a solution that certain countries, amongst which was, of course, Britain and Italy, would devalue. But you insisted that every country in the ERM should devalue against the Deutschmark. And this was rejected by the French. Would you like to comment on that?
It is true that we would have accepted a revaluation of the Deutsche Mark. As I've explained, we felt that a unilateral devaluation of sterling would simply leave us with higher interest rates. And I've explained that, in my opinion, the problem for the British economy was not so much the level of the exchange rate, although it's difficult to separate these things entirely, but the level of interest rates. And had we devalued, we would have had to pay higher interest rates, as countries that over the whole existence of the ERM who devalued had for years, the Dutch for a long time, the French for a while, had to pay higher rates. That is why we were not interested in a unilateral devaluation. We did talk to the Germans about having a revaluation of the Deutsche Mark alone, but the French were absolutely against that as well.
What happened with the departure from the IRM was not a reflection, as I judge it, on the Tory party. The real reflection was on the financial and economic system, which caused the government and all the other eight countries which you mentioned to lose control completely of what was happening. The same, the French expression is, débandade, moved onward towards the Far East. It doesn't seem to be right. This continues, in a manner of speaking, to this day, so to speak, because foreign exchange is a matter of gamble and has nothing to do with any of the kind of measures which you touched upon, like rising rates of interest or lower inflation or whatever you may choose.
Well, I believe in the free movement of capital. I don't believe in... I don't really agree with you. I believe in the free movement of capital. As long as you have the free movement of capital, the absence of exchange controls, you will have the opportunity for speculation. And I think that is the counterpart of a free economy. I've never had any problem with that. I don't, I've even had dinner with Mr. Soros. I didn't know I was going to have dinner with him. It was someone's idea of a joke. But I did. I certainly don't hold anything against George Soros. He saw an opportunity and he exploited it. No, I think the opportunities for speculation come from governments setting up artificial opportunities for them. So although I'm grateful to you, I actually don't think it's really the fault of the speculators.
David Marks from Blackstone Group. I wanted to ask Lord Lamont if he saw any parallels between himself in 1992 and, say, John Snow today, and likewise George Soros in 92 and, say, Chinese Central Bank today. And if you do, what kind of advice would you give to the US Treasury today?
Well, I think the situations are very different, obviously, because the dollar is floating freely. I view the depreciation of the dollar with some concern, but obviously with those huge deficits, the public sector deficit and the current account deficit, the depreciation of the dollar is likely to go on. You've got a sort of semi-fixed exchange rate system operating, of course, in the Far East, and I think there's a strong case for some of the currencies in the Far East to revalue. But I appreciate their concerns that until they've reformed their banking system, complete liberalization may be very difficult. I think the important thing is that America ought to address its deficit as quickly as possible.
William Keegan, the Observer. Norman, you've obviously concentrated on the domestic aspects of the chancellorship, but during your chancellorship, we saw the breakup of the Soviet Union, and I wondered whether you'd like to make any comments about that, because you witnessed a lot of that at first hand, what was done and what should have been done.
Yes, actually that took up quite a lot of my time, and I was very, very interested in that. And I count myself very fortunate that I saw a lot, not just of the finance ministers, but of both Presidents Yeltsin and Gorbachev. And we were able to give quite a lot of technical assistance to Russia, technical assistance in reforming their banking system, in improving their tax collecting. I remember also very well the privatization. There's an awful lot of criticism of the privatization today, and there's indeed cases in Russian courts relating to it. But I have to say my feeling at the time was that of relief that these large entities were privatized, even if it was not done in the most transparent way, if it was not done with an auction, always with the clearest rules. I think also one's got to remember that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, at one point, it really looked as though there was a possibility, I put it no higher than that, of the communists returning to power. And many of the people who bought assets in the former Soviet Union bought them with that risk. Overnight, of course, that risk went when the communists were not successful. But I've always had the greatest admiration for all those people like Gaidar, who I got to know well, Yavlinsky, who leads the Yabloko party. I think he lost his seat in the Duma. I've always been amazed at how well those people understood market economics. I once said to Gaidar, how is it you understand free market? I sometimes thought that these people understood market economics far better than people generally in the West. And Mr. Gaidar told me that he studied economics while pretending to be studying science. He was sitting back at the back of his lecture room actually reading economic textbooks. And I thought many of the people I met were very brave people and achieved a lot. The macroeconomic stabilization in the early 90s was quite a brave and bold achievement. I found that Mr. Gorbachev, who's somebody I very much admire, and I think we owe him a debt of gratitude. But I think the debt of gratitude we owe him is simply because he was a man who renounced violence. But he did suffer from an illusion that he could liberalize communism. And his understanding of economics was not that great. I remember him once saying to me, how can it be right that an umbrella on the black market sells for four times the amount it is in the shops? He got very, and he also thought that privatization would just lead to zillionaires, but of course that's exactly what did happen, I suppose, in Russia. But he had no concept that privatization could work out in a different way. Yeltsin, I thought, actually was very skillful the way, as in all democracies, Russia's not really a democracy, but as in all countries, tough economic measures are very unpopular, and privatization and the removing of price controls was very unpopular. Yeltsin was very skillful. He was much more committed to economic reform than Gorbachev, but he would always sack his finance minister and then replace him with another whose views were exactly the same, and went on and on and on.
Can I just ask, after all the macro stuff, about the personal cost? We've heard from several of your predecessors, and we view the current duo in numbers 10 and 11. You came to the chancellorship as a result of having played a pivotal role in the ascendancy of John Major to the premiership. You won him the 92 election. Is it always destined to go wrong between the Chancellor and the Prime Minister?
I think it probably is. I mean, I don't... I have pondered about this. I think the Prime Minister is always going to be much more political than the Chancellor of the Exchequer. The problem about being a finance minister is that you are in a minority of one in every meeting. Everybody always wants to spend more money. Everybody always wants to pursue a gradual approach. There's never to be any pain. Everything is to be lovely all the time. And nothing unpopular should be announced before a by-election or a party conference. And unless the Chancellor actually has the backing of the Prime Minister, I think he can't really do his job effectively. I think Mrs. Thatcher always sided very, very strongly with the Treasury, and I think that is a very great advantage. I think the advantage that New Labour have had is that Brown and Blair have operated together, rather isolating, as I read it, the rest of the government. I was amazed when they stuck to Tory plans immediately after the Tory spending plans immediately after the 1997 election, having spent the whole election denouncing us for wanting to make people homeless and tear down the hospitals with our own hands. They then announced they were going to do that themselves. But they did. The strange thing is, instead of feast and famine, it's been famine followed by feast rather than famine rather than the other way around. Initially, I believed that the stories about Brown and Blair were to some extent got up by the press. I think there is an awful lot of magnifying the relationship, and then people talk to advisors on both sides. After a while, these things take on a reality of their own, and it seems to me the Blair-Brown split has developed under the pressure of the magnifying glass, although there is undoubtedly a tension there and the personal position of the Chancellor.
May I ask you a question, Norman?
Please.
Is this working? The question I mentioned at the beginning. When we asked these chancellors who'd been there from 1974 to you, except for John Major, why they couldn't have had an inflation target, I didn't think they gave very convincing answers because, I mean, Germany had an inflation target, in effect, all that time in the mid-80s. I can't see why, if we'd had an inflation target introduced in the mid-80s, we could have avoided the inflation of the late 80s because the eye would have been more firmly fixed on inflation rather than getting muddled up with exchange rates shadowing the DM or this or that. Wouldn't it have been better to have had an inflation target all along?
Well, I think it would be quite difficult to introduce an inflation target when inflation is high, when it's in double figures, because it's going to be such a gradual thing. It may take years to achieve. I think it was easier to introduce it after we'd been through everything we have been through. I think we've ended up with a good policy almost by accident. First of all, we had monetary targets. We had then an eclectic policy that included a bit of exchange rate, a bit of monetary targets. Then we had exchange rate monetarism, and now we've ended up with an inflation target on the back of a low inflation rate. But I don't think it would have been easy, as I say, to introduce that had inflation been very high, because it would have been a gradual thing and would it have been persisted with. I think also, one shouldn't regard the inflation targeting as just an end to all argument about controlling inflation, because it depends, it still begs the question, how is inflation to be controlled? By what means? What weight is to be given to monetary policy? What weight is to be given to asset prices? What weight is to be given to the exchange rate? All the questions that we've been through could reappear again under the rubric of an inflation target. So, I mean, I'm very pleased that it has worked from 1992 to now, but I don't think, as I've said, it is the end of history. And I could imagine, I hope I won't see this, but I could imagine that depending who you put in the MPC, if you put the wrong people in the MPC, you might get the wrong answer and you might get incompetent inflation targeting. So I'm very flattered that everybody thinks I've found the answer to all our problems, but I'm not sure that I really believe it. Sam. Sorry, and then we'll take that.
One direction or in another.
Sorry?
I'm Samuel Britton. I was on the wrong side of the chairman for a long time this evening, but I want to come back to Kremlinology for a moment, and possibly to a question you'd really, you'd really prefer me not to ask, and that is, how satisfied were you that you were adequately warned by the Treasury, both of the difficulty of staying in the ERM and of the dangers, in other words, the economic undesirability of it? That's the first part of the question. And secondly, the Treasury and Bank of England together had a plan of campaign to preserve the ERM parity. How good do you think it was technically? In other words, I'm asking you to comment in a way I think you're slightly reluctant to do on the advice you received on these questions.
Well, I don't think, let me answer it this way. I did not foresee what happened on September the 16th. I did not foresee it. It hit me in the face, although after Dr. Schlesinger's remarks, I obviously saw it then. How far it was foreseeable, you may have your own opinion, but I did not foresee it. Looking back, I often think that I should have done, but I did not. When you put the other part of the question, the effects, was I warned about the effects on the real economy? Well, I could see that myself, and I think I was much more alarmist about that than my officials. I mean, in a way, I've been trying in my talk, I plead guilty to this, to get the best of all worlds, because I've been saying I was sceptical about this, but it did give us enormous benefits. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone. But I did see dangers from, as I said, December 1991 onwards. It was really the summer of 1992 when I made two demarches with John Major. I was worried that if we remained in, a recovery just could not happen except at a very anemic level. And I think that was a right judgment. I think most of the officials disagreed with me, all but one. They took the view, well, it's just the politicians haven't got the guts to soldier on. But actually, I think we would not have had a proper recovery had we carried on. And when I look at the subsequent history of France, the subsequent history of other European countries, I think we got much the better deal. I mean, one of the things that is vividly etched in my mind was the rate cut in January 1993. I don't even remember. I cut rates by 1% then. And the outcry that that caused, particularly from France and Ireland, I remember Bertie Ahern said, the UK isn't entitled to solve its own problems. Well, you could have knocked me over, so to speak. I think what was not foreseen also were the effects of German reunification. I have much more difficulty in working out whether that should have been foreseen or not, but that was not foreseen at all, and no one warned one in any way about that, but I'm not criticizing Fitch. What was the second part? Well, I don't think there was a contingency plan. Round about September the 16th, there was a lot of phoning Helmut Kohl and phoning the Bundesbank, but that didn't much good. And even if the Germans had made up their mind to try and assist us, I don't think it would have made any difference to the eventual outcome. The Germans acted entirely properly within the rules of the ERM, but only that and nothing more. It was interesting that in the summer of 1993, when the franc was forced off its parity, the Bundesbank spent a huge amount trying to support the franc, but that in the end was completely pointless. But there was no contingency plan.
This has been an amazing evening, really extraordinary.